This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our online and broadcast Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we're going to begin with a familiar story, especially to those of us in the far north, you know, in Fargo, perhaps. And we're going to talk with Todd Melby. He's a reporter, documentarian, and filmmaker, and he's very interested in the film Fargo, which came out in 1996. He's written a couple of books about it. The most recent is coming out this month, A Lot Can Happen in the Middle of Nowhere, The Untold Story of the Making of Fargo. It's its 25th anniversary. Todd, thanks for joining us today.
Sure thing, Doug. Great to be here.
Why did you want to write this book?
I wanted to write this because I'd never written a book before, because I'm super intrigued by movies, and because 5 years ago, my wife and I made a radio documentary about the movie, which aired on Prairie Public, and that just kind of got me obsessed with all these stories and just kind of wanted to dig deep into how the Coen brothers made what's become a classic.
And that online, or that documentary you did, was We Don't Talk Like That, Fargo and the Midwest Psyche. So what is it about Fargo, Todd?
Well, I think it was the first movie that defined North Dakota and Minnesota to the rest of the world. I mean, there'd been movies made about Italian-American crime folks and L.A. crime folks and Texans and Floridians, but never a movie that took place here, where we live, in our winters with our puffy coats and our big hats and of course, the accents.
And, of course, the way the snow squeaks when it's really cold.
Exactly. It does, right? I was just out there this morning. Yes.
This particular book deals with a piece of history that is, you know, about a film. So how did you pitch this to the Minnesota Historical Society Press?
Well, they want to know that you can write, and so they ask you to write a sample chapter, and they ask you to also write an outline. So I did the sample chapter and the outline, and that wasn't too difficult because I'd done the radio documentary already. So that's kind of how I got started. And then once they said yes, I just kind of dug in there and just started calling people until I, you know, after a couple of years of research, had talked to nearly four dozen people and had found all kinds of original source documents like early versions of the script, especially like a super, super early undated one, so I could compare how things had changed over time. I looked at actor audition tapes, production notes, and of course something called daily call sheets, which is what actors and crew members get to tell them what's going to happen the next day, and those would have instructions like, oh, we need this kind of prop, you know, we need this many extras. So that was super helpful to, you know, retell the story of what happened during the shooting in 1995.
William H. Macy played Jerry Lundegaard memorably, and he writes the introduction to the book.
Well, yeah, Macy was fantastic, and hopefully, you know, that helps get the word out about the book. One of the things that the Coen brothers told Macy was when he entered the house, you know, their house in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and he was coming in with his big coat on, that he should really just, you know, stomp his boots because there's going to be snow on the bottom of his boots. And so, like, I wanted those little details, like, what did the Coen brothers tell individual actors? What did the sound designer do to mimic the sound of the scraper on the windshield? What did the dialect coach say to the actors to get those long O's and long E's from the actors who weren't from North Dakota or Minnesota?
Now, you're writing a history book, essentially, here, without the two history makers, that is, Joel and Ethan Coen. What did you learn about their creative process in writing a script and directing a movie, and why wouldn't they participate in the book?
You're right. They didn't participate. They didn't. I get the sense, and I think it's pretty corroborated by, you know, watching them when they occasionally interact with other reporters, is that if they're not promoting a film or it's not some big special event, they probably aren't going to talk to you. It's very likely that they won't talk to you. I also didn't talk to Frances McDormand. But that often happens to reporters and journalists. It's rare that you get everybody. So I relied on things like in-depth interviews that they had done previously, and they'd done, you know, a fair number of those, and like a guest appearance that they did at the Walker Arts Center. And of course, the people that worked with them. I mean, the people that worked with them had all kinds of specific things about Joel and Ethan Coen.
Well, Fargo came out to the movie theaters in 1996, and their first movie, Blood Simple, made quite an impact when it came out in 1984. Since then, they've got a raft of movies. Do you have any sense of knowing what their opinion of Fargo is?
Of the movie Fargo?
Yes.
Absolutely. I think they didn't know or predict or think in their wildest dreams that it would be Oscar-worthy and a big, big hit and have all this long-term cultural implication and be made into a TV series. But this is the movie that really, really put, you know, made them, really. Because before this, they were independent, sort of almost cult directors. Their fifth film right before Fargo was called The Hudsucker Proxy. They had a $30 million budget for that, which is a lot of money for the mid-1990s. And they earned almost none of that back. It was a giant flop. And so they came back home to Minnesota to make a movie that they had already written on a relatively low budget. So I think the expectations that, you know, anyone would care about a snowbound crime thriller drama was pretty nil. But yet there was something about the movie, and a lot of it I think had to do with the character of Marge Gunderson that just really, really appealed to people. I mean, there's this crazy stuff happening, but Marge, she's this pregnant cop, she's from Brainerd, and she's got this can-do spirit, and she, you know, solves the crime. That sort of thing had never really been seen before.
How did Joel and Ethan Coen work together? I mean, they're brothers, obviously, but they create these movies. They're auteurs, in a sense. They create these worlds. How do they divide the labor, if you will?
I don't think they do divide the labor. They're basically two brains that operate as one brain. they spend so much time together that they know what the other one is thinking. I mean, not 100% of the time. I mean, there are discussions about, like, what's going to happen, what should we do here, or how do we solve this little creative problem? And they discuss that and try to figure out what the best solution to that is. But, you know, when they write the scripts, they're alone in a room saying all the lines out loud. They don't write separately and then come back together and compare notes. They write together. Then, of course, they're together all the time for pre-production and principal photography, et cetera, et cetera. And when you just spend that much time together, and especially if you're a brother and you like each other, which they must, then I think they begin to know what the other person's thinking. There's a guy named Don Bixcahill, who was the office production assistant on the film. And he said, like, if you were to listen to them talk to each other, you can't really understand what they're saying, because one of them will start a sentence and then the other one will finish it. It'll be like, well, maybe we could rent it. And you're not even sure what they're talking about.
I was intrigued when I was reading the book, and this is Todd Melby. We're talking about his new book, A Lot Can Happen in the Middle of Nowhere, The Untold Story of the Making of Fargo, just out from the Minnesota Historical Society Press, that they're pretty rigid about what they write for dialogue.
Absolutely. Their scripts are well-crafted, they are specific, and they're written in the dialect. So all of their movies are set in very specific places, West Texas, Arizona, New Orleans, and obviously in Fargo, Minnesota, North Dakota. And so for them, writing in a dialect is a way to get to the people in that specific place. And so in Fargo, there's 179 yas. really, 179.
How many you betchas?
Not very many. I think there's only a couple of those. Yeah, I think the you betcha thing is like a little overtold by people who are appreciating the movie. But there are lots of, instead of believe me, it's a blee me, like one word. And instead of 100 for 100, they spell it hunnert, H-U-N-N-E-R-T. So that's like one of the ways for them to really get into a specific place.
One of the interesting parts of the book is how some of the actors struggled with or were challenged by the dialect. And you had an accent coach who talked to you about that process as well, didn't you?
Yeah, she did. Elizabeth Himmelstein. And Elizabeth is a dialect coach. And there are these folks who have this specialty in Hollywood. And usually, you know, what she does is try to mask like an Australian or New Zealand accent when that actor is performing in America, say Nicole Kidman. But in this case, you know, her job was to teach non-Minnesotans, non-North Dakotans how to speak in the Fargo dialect. So this would be Francis McDormand, William H. Macy, those two people especially. And Macy comes from a school of acting where it's all about motivation, not so much about background of character. And so he was doing the dialect some, but he wasn't all in. And then he heard some Minnesotans come into an elevator that he was in during pre-production, and they were talking about the weather, and they're like, "Oh, it's real cold out there." And then when the Minnesotans left, you know, he turned to Himmelstein and he said, "I'm all in. I'm doing it."
In the preface to the book, Todd, you say Fargo paints North Dakota and Minnesota as icy hellscapes for dunderheads. Still, I can't help liking the film. Explain that dichotomy.
I mean, I'm from Western North Dakota. I was born there. I went to high school there. I reported a lot in Western North Dakota on the oil boom. I mean, I love North Dakota and I love Minnesota. But, you know, it is an icy hellscape. I mean, there's no way around that. I mean, there are times in the winter. I'm not a cross-country skier, so I'm not one of those people that completely embrace outdoor sports or outdoor activities in the winter. But, you know, I'm always afraid I'm going to fall down when I walk to the car because it's so icy. You know, it gets dark. It's cold. Those aren't pleasant things for me. So I think, like, their portrayal of Minnesota and North Dakota as this icy hellscape is an accurate one. I mean, that is what it's like here. And some of us struggle with that. But yet the film is so fun, right? It's just like, it's endearing. I think it's both. I think they're making fun of us, but they also enjoy us. I think there's a little bit of both.
On page 137 in the book, Todd, I came across this and I was a little surprised to see it. And that is, you talk about how the Coens feel about Minnesota. You mentioned that they fled to New York. They made a movie that pokes fun at Minnesota, in which many Minnesotans are portrayed as simpletons and buffoons. And I remember seeing the movie for the first time screened at the Fargo Theater, you know, when it was being released. And there was this sort of uncomfortable pall that fell over the theater at times. I was laughing a lot, as lots of other people were too. But there were some people who were clearly uncomfortable. And it was like they were seeing something they didn't quite want to see.
Yeah, no one likes to look at themselves in the mirror. I mean, unless you're a supermodel or something, right? And so what this movie did was to show us, like, how we really are. And I think it goes beyond the accent. And it, you know, certainly there's the food, you know, the chicken fricassee and the Swedish meatballs and the Arby's. There's the puffy coats. But there's also this sort of, I mean, what people say is Minnesota nice? There's this undercurrent that there's this belief that the world can really be normal when the Coens believe that it's really not normal, that, you know, there's this, you know, there's a dark side to it. And so that's basically, I think, one of the things that they're saying is that there's this dark underbelly of tension underneath this, like, veneer of North Dakota, Minnesota nice. And I think that's what Steve Buscemi's character is always bumping up against. I mean, he's the outsider. He's the stranger in the strange land. He's poorly dressed for the elements. He doesn't have a hat. His gloves are little leather gloves. He has a jacket that's not a parka. And his character is very direct, and the Minnesotans are not direct. And I think the big example of that is when he goes to pay for long-term parking. And once he steals the license plates at the top of the airport parking lot, and he doesn't want to pay the $4 for long-term parking. And, you know, the guy in the little booth, he's like, "But long-term parking charges by the day." And, you know, Buscemi gets upset. He's like, "You know, there are limits to your life, man." And he's just always bumping up against this sort of Minnesotans who want to play by the rules and just be nice.
Yeah, Minnesota nice is kind of a two-edged sword in the movie and in the book you've written here. As Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare were just so outstanding as the bad guys.
Because
they always reminded us that sometimes people are criminals because they're not very bright.
Exactly. Right.
And they're rather nuanced in their own ways, too. I mean, the fact that they can't really have a conversation with each other, even though they're working this heavy crime. time. And you kind of get into that with other characters as well. The difficulty, you know, actually revealing yourself. That very famous scene in the restaurant between Marge Gunderson and the would-be boyfriend, if you will. That's just one scene that people remember decades later.
That is a fantastic scene. And, you know, it's a lot longer than you think it is. I went and timed it, and it's about 4 minutes. And my memory would have thought, well, maybe that's just a little 90-second scene. But it's really 4 minutes. And so Stephen Park lives in Los Angeles. He played the character of Mike Yanagita. And he'd been in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. He'd been on TV before. Super seasoned actor, you know, when the Coen brothers approached him. And he didn't really get the role at first because the Coen brothers were looking for someone who was bald and paunchy. But then once he kind of dove into Mike Yanagita's experience about being being Asian and feeling out of place in the suburbs of Minneapolis in 1987, which is, you know, the time that the story took place, there was just a desperation that he brought to that character. And sadness. And so, like, as he's playing all that straight and we watch it later, we can be like like sort of shocked and feeling sorry for him, but also at the same time laughing. I mean, it's just he's so desperate.
Todd Melby is the author of the new book, A Lot Can Happen in the Middle of Nowhere, The Untold Story of the Making of Fargo. And I should mention that we will have a Prairie Public Presents event on Sunday at 4 Central Time, and you can go to prairiepublic.org to sign up for it. But it's an online webinar featuring Todd, and we'll be talking about the book and the characters that he touched bases with to sort of round out the story. And we invite all of our listeners to join the webinar and maybe engage in some kind of interaction. We might have some email questions we can pose. But it's an interesting story, and it's 25 years after the release of the movie, so it's a kind of an interesting time to reflect on it.
Yeah. And we're also going to be joined by Tony Denman, who played Scotty Lundegaard.
Yes, who was a kid then, and now, of course, he's an adult with kids of his own, right?
Exactly.
One of the challenges that the Coen brothers had in producing Fargo, kind of strangely enough, was they couldn't find snow, and it got to be a bit of a crisis.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, it was. It was a big, big crisis. Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the movie takes place inside, but the main scenes that really show the winter here, of course, need to have snow. And you can fake that in small scenes. You can hire people that actually manufacture snow, and they have these things called snow guns, like the top of the airport parking ramp that we were just talking about. That was all manufactured snow. Like, there were guys up there with these, quote, snow guns, like, all night, you know, sort of making the snow. But when you get to, like, big scenes like Steve Buscemi burying the money or Marge investigating the triple homicides, you need real snow. And so there was no snow in Minneapolis-St. Paul in the winter of 1995, except for the occasional day or two. So they just gave up about 26 years ago, you know, right around March 10th. I'd have to check the exact dates in the book. But right about then, they just, like, decided, okay, we're going to go to Grand Forks. Like, no more. So they went to Grand Forks, stayed at the Holiday Inn, and they went even further north to shoot a bunch of the scenes. Like, right around Grafton, North Dakota was where the triple homicide scene was filmed. And there was also a scene filmed in and around Halleck, Minnesota.
Was it Roger Deakins? Was he the cinematographer?
Yes, right.
You mentioned that parking ramp scene. There is a brilliant shot, basically, of that car that Steve Buscemi was supposedly driving going into that parking ramp. It's a wide shot, and it looks like it would have had to have been done in one take because they'd spent so much time putting snow there, they didn't want a lot of tracks, I assume.
Exactly. That was done in one take, and you know, the Coens just left the camera there and watched the entire car, you know, come up to the top of the parking ramp and kind of do a big, almost 360-degree circle before, you know, the car stops. And the guy who made the snow, the snowmaker, Dieter Sturm, he told me that he was watching that. And then as you notice, at some point the snow gets a little deep and the car kind of almost slows down and almost gets stuck. And he said, you know, he was just holding his breath, hoping the car would make it through the snow.
Well, it does, and it's, I guess, they were willing to take a bit of a risk, I take it, that because the snow is so important in telling that piece of the story, for that matter, when they go to the lake and we see the wood chipper and all that kind of stuff. You know, it wouldn't be the same if it weren't this kind of bleak, monochromatic landscape.
Exactly, yeah. And I also analyze, you know, the different ways that they say white and snow in the book. I mean, it's just a matter of like going through the screenplay and how they wanted snow clods and snow fields and all white and white this and white that. And so when you look at the color palette of the film, it's of course white and then brown for kind of the color of the clothes that most of the characters are wearing most of the time. And then of course red for the two red ice scrapers, the one that Jerry uses and of course the one that Steve Buscemi uses when he buries the suitcase in the snow, and of course red for blood. So you've got your white, browns, and reds.
You mentioned the suitcase in the snow. That is a famous scene as well, because we wonder how in the world is he ever going to find that suitcase because it's just this barren wasteland and he picks a particular piece of fence to put it under. And also the scene with Bane Belke where he's kind of pushing slush out of his driveway. Again, a reminder that this time of year we're always busy with it. I do want to talk with you, though, about another scene in the movie that was a little bit controversial when I was reading it. I was thinking, what were they thinking? And that's the two young women who were hired to be the hookers that played opposite Stormare and Buscemi. There was a nudity incident, wasn't there, during the production of this?
Yes. Well, there's something called a nudity clause, which is something that the directors have actors sign if the actor is going to be nude in the movie. And so Joel and Ethan didn't ask the actors, Larissa Kokerno and Melissa Peterman, to sign a nudity clause until after one of the scenes is already filmed. So, you know, scenes are filmed out of order. And so in the case of the women that played hooker number one and hooker number two, they first shot the scene in the strip club, you know, where they're talking to Frances McDormand's character about what they remember and what they didn't remember. That very funny head bobbing scene. Yes. And usually if you're going to ask actors to do this, you're going to tell them after they've been cast, certainly before the movie shooting, you know, whether or not you want nudity. And so in the Coen's vision, that after the sex scene in the motel room, the women would be sitting up in bed and their breasts would be exposed. That was kind of their vision for them as they watched The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And Larissa wasn't down for that. She's like, well, if you wanted this, you should have asked for it earlier. It feels kind of like a bait and switch when you're asking for it now after we've already, you know, filmed this one scene. And oh, by the way, I don't think it's essential to them vegging out and watching TV. I mean, you know, it's just not part of the gag. I don't see what the gag is and why it's necessary. So she refused to sign it, and so did her colleague, Melissa Peterman.
Well, the movie begins with, this is a true story, and it isn't.
No,
it was apparently
not at all.
Inspired by some things that had happened, but it is a quirky, wonderful movie, and 25 years later, it still is a fun movie to watch. And we'll be talking about it on Sunday with Todd Melby, the author of The Untold Story of the Making of Fargo. Again, it will be a webinar available online at 4 Central, and you can sign up for it at prairiepublic.org. Todd, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you on Sunday.
Coming up on Main Street, a discussion with Donna Kaz, who leads the theater troupe Guerrilla Girls on Tour. First, the news.